Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of a recent episode exploring the history of investors holding businesses accountable and the dawn of the ESG, or Environmental Social Governance, movement.
Add a berry blast off for your day with the new Berry Pebbles. A berry twist on a classic breakfast. Perfect for giving those growing minds a blast of creativity. With a new berry way to Pebbles. Yabba dabba do you with Berry Pebbles. Head to postpebblescereal.com to learn more. Yabba dabba do and the Flintstones and all related characters and elements, copyright and trademark Hanna-Barbera.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is The Jackpod, where On Point news analyst Jack Beatty helps us connect history, literature, and politics in a way that brings his unique clarity to the world we live in now. Now, that world, I should be totally transparent, also includes some major internet problems. So today, I've picked up a tin can, Jack has picked up a tin can in New Hampshire, we've put some string between the two, and he joins us that way. Hello, Jack.
Hello,
Meghna. Okay. So it's episode 24, and of course, we're going to talk about President Biden's State of the Union address. But what's your headline for it, Jack?
Still.
Still, meaning what?
Well, it's a distinction that Carlos Lozada, a brilliant columnist for the New York Times and a reader of political biographies and speeches, it's a word that he uses to describe the one word that sort of stands for Joe Biden, and he contrasts still with the word that is the essential to Trump again. Here's an example of what he means. Here's Biden. We have to show the world that America is still a beacon of life, of light, I beg your pardon. We have to prove that democracy still works. We are still an America that believes in honesty and decency and justice for all. And Lozada writes, still is about holding on to something good that may be slipping away. Again, Trump's mantra is about bringing back something that was wrested away. This election is a contest between still and again, between the politics of memory and the politics of hope.
So still as in a nation that is resolute in its values and capabilities. Really interesting way of looking at it, Jack. So, I mean, there's a lot of examples of Biden having done this in the State of the Union address. Let's just dive into the first one. He talked a lot about Ukraine and Russia. It was the first major issue in the State of the Union from President Biden.
But now, assistance to Ukraine is being blocked by those who want to walk away from our world leadership. It wasn't long ago when a Republican president named Ronald Reagan thundered, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." Now, my predecessor, a former Republican president, tells Putin, quote, "Do whatever the hell you want." That's a quote. A former president actually said that, bowing down to a Russian leader. I think it's outrageous, it's dangerous, and it's unacceptable.
So, Jack, we'll talk about the applause versus the heckling in a little bit, but what did you think of the president's remarks on Ukraine?
Well, I applaud him for beginning with it. There's no more important issue, I think, right now, because it contains everything. It contains our historical legacy. You know, essentially what won the Cold War against Soviet Russia was containment and collective security. Donald Trump threatens both. He says to the thuggish Russia under Putin, "We won't contain you. Do whatever the hell you want." And he says to collective security, to NATO, to the institution that gave the world, after the 20th century slaughter of major continental wars, gave the world 50 years of peace. He wants NATO to go away. Biden is essentially saying Trump's foreign policy is setting the clock back, not to 1945, but to 1939, to the Charles Lindbergh pacifist, stay away from the world. That's the clock they want to turn back to. And again, it brings home how they are a party, as he says, again and again, locked into the past. But here, a deep past.
And as you and you've noted, Jack, and many others did, President Biden very judiciously avoided saying Donald Trump's name, but he did say my predecessor several times. And as we just heard about Trump having told Putin, do whatever the hell you want. Well, President Biden said instead, this is what he would tell the Russian president.
My message to President Putin, who I've known for a long time, is simple. We will not walk away. We will not bow down. I will not bow down.
Jack, what did you make about that moment in particular?
Well, I wanted to cheer it because what a contrast to one of the most disgraceful moments in U.S. diplomacy in my lifetime. Trump at Helsinki bowing down to Putin. How anyone could conceive of that man as president after that, I don't know. But in the flow of outrages, it just became another outrage. But it's more than that. This is a Putinist Republican Party in many ways, not the whole of it. Thank heaven. I think there's even a substantial body of Republicans whom, if the Speaker, Mike Johnson, would allow, would vote for aid for Ukraine. And, of course, Russia seeming to control Trump. Why? How could this have happened that a foreign leader, so foul, a murderer, a thug, could have this paramountcy in our politics?
Well, Jack, honestly, I feel like with every issue that Biden talked about in the State of the Union, the responses he got, we could spend an entire jackpot on each one of those issues. But if you'll forgive me, let's move on to the next one, because there are quite a few. Of course, the president spoke a great deal about abortion. So here's a couple of moments. This is first when Biden talked about women's electoral power.
Those bragging about overturning Roe v. Wade have no clue about the power of women. But they found out when reproductive freedom was on the ballot, we won in 2022 and 2020, and we'll win again in 2024.
So the president, they're trying to rally the women's vote. In addition to that, he really focused on a recent major issue that falls within the question of abortion, and that has to do with IVF. So President Biden told the story of LaToria Beasley, a social worker from Alabama, who was unable to go forward with plans to have a second child via IVF because of the Alabama Supreme Court's recent move to essentially ban it. And Beasley was in attendance at the State of the Union.
She scheduled treatments to have that second child. The Alabama Supreme Court shut down IVF treatments across the state, unleashed by a Supreme Court decision overturning Roe v. Wade. She was told her dream would have to wait. What her family had got through should never have happened. Unless Congress acts, it could happen again. So tonight, let's stand up for families like hers. To my friends across the aisle, don't keep this waiting any longer. Guarantee the right to IVF. Guarantee it nationwide.
Jack, what do you think?
Well, one of the president's critics on the left complained that he never actually used the word abortion. He is a devout Catholic and he runs from the word. He rarely uses it. He did say, though, reproductive rights, the key word there being rights. You know, just as the Republicans have set themselves against the world strategy that the United States had from 1945, containment and collective security. So the Republican Party has set itself against the dominant impulse of American society, which is the expansion of rights and freedom. Indeed, the Republicans, far from being conservative, want to use the power of government to change society, to make America, to bring us back again to where we were in the 1950s. It is a profoundly reactionary and in its implications, even authoritarian view. Use government against the changes in society, against the autonomy, the sexual autonomy and reproductive rights of women, against voting rights, against all the changes that the status panicking white voters who flock to Trump want abolished. They want to set the clock back to the 1950s. And again, that's what makes them the party of memory. And indeed, they practice the politics of revenge. We're going to get at the people who are making the changes in society we don't like. But it's unprecedented in America to have a party that wants to use the government to set society back.
Well, Jack, the State of the Union is always a president's opportunity to talk about what he believes are successes thus far in his administration. And President Biden definitely was no exception to that. He spent quite a bit of time talking about achievements on drug prices and health care.
Folks, the Affordable Care Act, the old Obamacare, is still a very big deal. Over 100 million of you can no longer be denied health insurance because of pre-existing condition. But my predecessor and many in this chamber want to take this prescription drug away by repealing the Affordable Care Act. I'm not going to let that happen.
Jack, I have to correct myself here because obviously in that clip there, Biden wasn't talking about an achievement specifically to his administration, but rather him protecting against the rollback of Obamacare. Why do you think he did that?
I think he's using it because it is now part of the texture of American life. And Trump gave a tremendous hostage to fortune when he said he wants to repeal it again. All over the country, Republican consultants were slapping their heads and saying, why did he do that? That should be poison, and we'll have to see if Biden can make hay with it.
It's only poison, though, if reality can muscle aside ideology, which I'm not sure it can. And that's actually a little hint of something I want to talk about towards the end of our conversation today, Jack. But let's get to immigration and the border, which was a major part of Biden's State of the Union address, not just because of what he said, but of course, because of the reactions that he got from one half of the House, at least. So first of all, let's just listen quickly to the president talking about details of the negotiations that he had with leaders from both parties in the House and Senate. Biden talked about reaching an historic deal on the border, which, of course, never went through because, as Biden says, former President Donald Trump reportedly called members of Congress and told them not to pass this immigration deal. So here's what Biden said.
I will not demonize immigrants saying they are poison in the blood of our country. I will not separate families. I will not ban people because of their faith. Unlike my predecessor, on my first day in office, I introduced a comprehensive bill to fix our immigration system. Take a look at it, as all these and more. Secure the border, provide a pathway to citizenship for dreamers, and so much more. But unlike my predecessor, I know who we are as Americans.
Okay, so Jack, of course, once again, Biden referring to this immigration and border deal that was negotiated by including some leading Republican senators. I noticed the camera frequently turned to Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma, who was the leading Republican on this, and his He was stony-faced for sure. A lot of the reactions from the chamber came from heckling from Republicans when Biden talked about the border, and the president did not shy away from going off script when those heckles came.
The Border Patrol Union has endorsed this bill. The Federal Chamber of Commerce isn't. Yeah, yeah. You're saying low. Look at the facts. I know you know how to read.
Jack, what do you think?
Well, President Biden has been criticized by progressives for using the word illegal. He went on to speak about he picked up some sort of medallion that Marjorie Taylor Greene slipped him as he was walking down the aisle to the rostrum. And it had the name of a person who was murdered by a undocumented immigrant. And Biden, alluding to this person, called him an illegal, which had, you know, progressives slapping their foreheads. And is a dehumanizing term indeed. But the larger point, consider this. By stopping this immigration deal, stopping this bipartisan, toughest immigration border deal the government has ever come up with. By stopping that, Trump is essentially saying to more murderers, come on, come into the country. I'm not going to stop you. Well, we're not going to hire all those new judges. We're not going to put on all that new equipment. We're not going to hire all those new border patrol people to keep you out. Come on in. So on the one hand, Trump is making hay viciously, racistly out of these particular crimes. On the other hand, he's saying, but you can keep doing it until Election Day. I think the Democrats have a good comeback now that Trump has essentially scuppered and ordered his puppets to kill this deal. And it was a test of it in that Long Island congressional race a couple of weeks ago where, you know, running on that against a Republican who, you know, didn't want the border deal, a Democrat did very well.
Okay. Well, Jack, let's take a minute to talk about one issue which the president has been roundly criticized for, especially from members of his own party, and that is his handling of the conflict between Israel and Hamas and the suffering of Gazans there as Israel continues its military campaign against Hamas. You and I have talked about this a lot. We've talked about it on the show a great deal about Biden's failures to use the leverage that the United States ostensibly has on Israel, right? So, I mean, that's a clear area of very legitimate criticism for the president. And Biden touched on that in the State of the Union. He said his administration has been working, quote, nonstop to establish a 6-week ceasefire in Gaza. And he acknowledged the devastating loss that Israel did indeed experience on October 7th. But then followed with also noting that 30,000 Palestinians in Gaza have now been killed.
Israel must allow more aid into Gaza to ensure humanitarian workers aren't caught in the crossfire. And they're announcing they're going to have a crossing in northern Gaza. To the leadership of Israel, I say this. Humanitarian assistance cannot be a secondary consideration or a bargaining chip. Protecting and saving innocent lives has to be a priority. As we look to the future, the only real solution to the situation is a two-state solution over time.
Now, that got applause, Jack, but to me it also sounds like, in terms of how the Israeli leadership would receive that, as Joe Biden speaking to an empty room, honestly.
Yes, the Netanyahu government is completely opposed to a two-state solution. That running against Oslo, which was the process leading to that, revived Netanyahu's career. So there's a direct conflict between what we want and what the Israeli government is willing to give. And I think that gets to this humanitarian issue too. All well and good to have dropping stuff from the air and so on, all well and good to put in a pier to, get in quantities of food and so on. But the fact remains, Biden hasn't got the Israeli government to open up the ports of entry in the south and in the north to allow enough food in. One phone call from Joe Biden could change that. He hasn't made it. And the phone call would be, you want our aid, you open up those corridors, you get people the food they need, or else you're not, you know, American aid is going to stop. Biden hasn't, and it's both a moral and probably a political failure on his part.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, so one more here, Jack. This is how Biden closed his State of the Union address.
I see a future where defending democracy, you don't diminish it. I see a future where we restore the right to choose and protect our freedoms, not take them away. I see a future where the middle class finally has a fair shot, and the wealthy have to pay their fair share in taxes. I see a future where we save the planet from the climate crisis and our country from gun violence. Above all, I see a future for all Americans.
So, Jack, your overall thoughts, and was the State of the Union address a net win for Biden or not?
I think clearly it was. It was vigorous to the point of shouting. Showed plenty of energy, and if you were worried about, apparently there was a colloquy with Jerry Nadler, the Democratic congressman from New York, who said, people won't talk about cognitive failure now. And Biden said, Jesus, sometimes I wish I had cognitive failure. So the president showed last night he can bring his energies, which are not the same as they were 30 years ago, but he can bring what he has to the occasion. He met it last night in terms of his volume. There's no question about it.
Mm. Well, Jack, so here's the only thought that I wish to share in our conversation today, because I was really eager to hear what you thought about the address from the president. And it's well within our capacity. Of course, it's within our capacity to, take a fine-tooth comb to everything that Biden claimed and do some vigorous analysis on it, which we partially did, but there's a lot of things to also criticize, perhaps even further in his speech. And I wish we were living in America right now where we could have chosen to spend our time in this podcast to do that, but we just don't. And here's why. What I focused on, in addition to what the president was saying, was how members of the Republican Party were reacting. Right. I mean, we're long past the time where people have to oh my gosh, there's a lot of heckling. I don't love it, but it is what it is. However, if you removed the name Joe Biden and Democratic president from a lot of what he said in this address, you would get things like America standing up against Russian aggression. You would get a president saying, let's prohibit political violence on U.S. soil. You would get a president saying, let's not have an insurrection or violence preventing the peaceful transfer of power in the United States. You would get a president saying, let's put more Border Patrol agents on the southern border. You would get a president saying, let's do more to help third graders in this country learn how to read. These, in normal times, would be bipartisan applause lines. But I could not help but to notice how the Republican half of the chamber this week sat for every single one of those once universally American ideals. Didn't applaud, sat down. And I thought, how is it possible that the Republican Party has become, I don't think I'm going to regret saying this, so unpatriotic and so un-American that they can't even stand when a president says, let's get children to learn how to read. It was truly astonishing to me. I hope this is not me being partisan. I'm not a registered Democrat. I try to consider myself purely an American citizen. But I was really taken aback by that.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. These were unexceptionable. These are the kinds of things you just throw in there for the, you know, displays of unity. Gone. Why? You stand up and the adjudicated rapist in down there at Mar-a-Lago is going to see who stands up. He has this party in his hands and he is taking names and numbers. And, you know, it's a lot like the meetings of the Communist Central Committee under Stalin. He would note, he'd say something and they'd all applaud. And he would note the ones that sat down first. Trump, just the same. Just the same. He would be watching, and whoever stood up would feel the wrath of Trump and Trump's, followers. It's appalling. And, you know, it tells us everything about this election, where the campaigns began. Trump's began at Waco, the scene of that David Koresh cult and the massacre, the burning and so on. Terrible moment. Stands for insurrection, stands for anti-government, stands for nihilism. Joe Biden began his campaign at Valley Forge, an emblem really of still, of how the patriots of 1777 still prevailed, sacrificed, and still stood out that winter to be able to recover in the spring. And he in that Valley Forge speech, he asked the question that I think the election poses. He says, we all know who Donald Trump is. The question is, who are we?
Mm. Well, Jack, on that note, I think you provided us with the question that we're going to ask our Jackpod listeners this week. Who are we? Listeners, what do you think? Who are we? And who best reflected who we are in the State of the Union address and the Republican response? We want to hear that from you. So as always, run to your phone, look on the On Point Vox Pop app, or if you don't have it, look for On Point Vox Pop. Get the app and give us your feedback about Jack's thoughts on the State of the Union address and the Republican response. Okay, Jack, so with that, I'm going to quickly transition to telling you that regarding responses that you got from last week's Jackpod, they included the words depressing, scary, disturbing, and even one bleepable response. We're going to hear that when we come back from this quick break. And also, listeners, I just want you to know that both our head engineer, James Ross, and our director, Eileen Amata, are now holding hands and trying to hold the fraying thread. That's connecting our two tin cans between Boston and Jack's house in New Hampshire. So hopefully we'll just kind of keep that thread together, and we'll be back with you in just a moment.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the balanced scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big, whoa, kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.
Well, Jack, we are back now. And last week, we asked Jackpod devotees what they thought of your analysis about low information voters and how our democracy seems to be riding on the choices made by those voters. And here's what they said.
I am terrified that low information voters continue to gain power, and now they have the chance to destroy our democracy. I am so concerned about this that I am actively trying to leave the United States.
Okay, that was Andrew Russo from Beaverton, Oregon. Here's Laura Reich in Charlotte, North Carolina.
I really found the episode about the low information voters, while not surprising, I found it very disturbing. People just want to hear what they want to hear, and they really don't explore it further. And I really am terrified that we are going to lose our democracy at the next election.
Jack, you've got people terrified now. We're still 8 months away from the election. What do you make of that?
I'm sorry to spread gloom. I mean, Andrew wants to leave the country. We've actually heard that before, haven't we, from listeners? I think probably it matters more than ever to stay in the country, that American democracy is still worth fighting for, fighting understood to mean, you know, going to the polls and speaking to people and trying to, you know, reach low information voters. On that score, and this is something that would probably depress Laura too, there was a survey released by a Democratic group this week looking at a sample of voters in Pennsylvania. Now, the question I was talking about last week was how few even Republican voters know about Donald Trump's legal troubles, or how little they know about the stuff that's been making headlines for months. So that was depressing. This survey actually showed something even worse. It showed how few voters really know about his threats against democracy. How few had heard about poisoning the blood of the country. How few had heard about, dictator for a day. How few had heard about setting up camps, internment camps, for the millions of undocumented people, and probably lots and lots of Americans, too, that he means to put in those camps. They didn't know that. Mm. Yet when the study people running it told and quoted Trump saying these things to these same people who didn't know about it, their views changed. It wasn't that they became stridently anti-Trump, but they certainly said, what? He said that? And that makes me think the fact that they can actually seemingly to change opinion slightly, that tells me the Democrats, there's a target there for advertising. Just let Trump convict himself, but do it repetitiously to the point of epic monotony. Let everybody know about poisoning the blood, about the dictatorship, about the camps, about all the rest. Make it so that you put it intellectual skywriting, put it right up there so that you can't escape it on television. And this survey would suggest it can move marginally. It can move a pin.
Wow. Well, so let's now go to the man with the view from Elkhart. This is our friend in Indiana, Howard Turner.
So what is the excuse for the low information voter before the social media algorithms of just showing us the topics that we already believe in, before Fox brought us the one-sided news stories, before CNN brought us the 24-hour rehash of the same news stories? We had working class voters voting to give the owner class tax cuts and the voting for free trade instead of fair trade policies that were somehow magically going to enrich the working class.
Okay, Jack, I have to say, I always love hearing from Howard because I think he's making an extremely important point here. Look, we are living in a world where all of us, regardless of your political outlook, can easily fall into a self-echoing information silo. I just want to make that clear. But, you know, he's also basically saying, look, where's the starting point to break out of that? And Howard says it's education beginning way back in, like, pre-K. What do you think?
Well, Howard, I'm glad to hear there's a spark of of reform. Howard, he often sounds like he's ready to, you know, things are so bad that's beyond remedy. It isn't. And maybe that is the place to begin. And but, you know, the media environment really does matter. I don't mean to be a foxphobe, but by God, when you just see the studies of what people don't know who watch that and how that is part of Republican identity, you know, the 15 million viewers a night and so on are three times that number in terms of the people they've reached and talked to. They don't mention the Trump dictatorship. They don't talk about the Trump's legal woes. They talk about Hunter Biden. They talk about whatever the conspiracy theory of the day is. And they make millions off this. This guy, Murdoch. You know, I'm all for immigration. But when the day he landed on our shores was an evil day for this republic. There's no question about it. The corruption of that institution and the role it plays and the baneful role it plays in the Republican mind. We've never had anything like that in this country.
Mm. Well, one could argue that there's worse now even than Fox News out there because of social media and right. other news outlets. But I want to play one more here. And it's from Chris in California. But before we play it, I just want to let folks know that On Point senior editor Dori Scheimer and I went back and forth about whether or not we should play this listener thought here. We decided to do it, and I'll explain why afterwards. But I want to make it clear that all due respect to Chris in California, but as a program, we're not endorsing what he's saying here, but we felt it was important for people to hear. So here it is.
I think Jack's analysis is correct, but I also think it's a little too generous. I'm going to be honest. I know that, and I have a lot of these folks in my family, but when are we going to start calling these people stupid? And I don't mean to be vulgar, but I mean, come on. This is ridiculous. We're becoming the laughing stock of the world. I don't know. It's like the fundamentals of of just basic things like how to tell when an election isn't stolen, how to fact check, things like this. Is just like, I don't think people even consider learning if they don't know how. I mean, I'm just beside myself. I'm not optimistic, you guys. I'm sorry.
So, Jack, I'm going to want to hear from you in just a second, but let me explain why we were sort of debating about whether or not to play this. Obviously, the curse word that he used, we could easily bleep that, which we did. But, you know, we take our responsibility about presenting, news and information that is trustworthy and fair very, very seriously. And one of the major problems right now in the United States is, you know, whether Democrats want to believe it or not, but there is a huge percentage of this country that feels deeply insulted, deeply aggrieved by the kinds of things that they hear elite Americans saying about them. And just writing off, Chris, all due respect, man, but just writing off millions of Americans as being, you know, bleeping stupid does nothing but inflame that that grievance. And so that was why I was a little cautious or reluctant to play that clip because we didn't want to be part of that. But on the other, and also, just to state a fact, there are a lot of stupid people everywhere on the political spectrum in America. Mm-hmm. But we decided in the end to play it because, you know, Chris is expressing a frustration which many people have. And I wanted to also ask you about sort of that, that challenge of trying to find a way to speak across political perspectives without inflaming grievances or while at the same time acknowledging how, you know, one feels about the condition of the country, Jack?
Well, you know, there's a line in Faulkner, people are better than their circumstances. There's a lot in that. I think that's true of Trump voters, too. They're better than that. They're better than Fox News, but that's what they get. They're better than Trump, but that's what they get. And for tribal reasons, for reasons of identity, for reasons, as you put it, of the sort of solidarity and grievance, they stick to the big lie and the big liar. But I have to believe that they can wake up. You know, I quoted Václav Havel, the Czech politician and brilliant writer, last week, making a distinction between living in the lie and living in the truth. And he says it happens at the macro level, where whole societies live in a lie, or they pretend to, as people under communism did. They pretended to believe. And then people begin to break away. The green grocer doesn't put the sign "Workers of the World Unite" in his shop window. That little moment of defiance is a moment of living in the truth. And Havel says this can happen to individuals. So I think it can happen to the Trump people too. They are better than their circumstances. They're certainly better than this candidate. And you know, while we're talking about better, we think of Lincoln's better angels of our nature. He was invoking them, of course, as the South was seceding and Fort Sumter was about to be assaulted. So the better angels took a long time to come. And maybe it's going to take a long time to come for so many Americans to begin living in the truth again.
Well, Jack, regardless of how rickety the internet connection between us is and how frayed that thread between our two tin cans may be, your hope and aspirations for this country always ring loud and clear. So thank you as always, Jack.
Thank you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is The Jackpot from On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big whoa kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.